amazing. But you're a lady. Forget my troubles. Tell me how your mother is. As usual, she wanted me to talk about myself, but I didn't yield. Moving from my mother, from her worries about Elisa and my brothers, I led her back to the Saladas. She grumbled. She said sarcastically that men place such an enormous importance on fucking. She laughed. Not Marcello, although even he doesn't joke, but Michele, who went crazy. He's been obsessed with me for a long time, and even runs after the shadow of my shadow. She repeated that expression elusively, shadow of my shadow. She said that was why Marcello was angry and threatened her. He couldn't bear the fact that she had put a leash on his brother and led him in directions that, in his view, were humiliating. She laughed again. She muttered, Marcello thinks he can scare me. But look, the only person who really knew how to scare people was his mother, and you know how she ended up. As she talked, she kept touching her forehead. She complained of the heat, of the slight headache she'd had since the morning. I understood that she wanted to reassure me, but also, in a contradictory manner, show me a little of what was there where she lived and worked every day. Behind the facade of the houses, on the streets of the new neighborhood and the old one. Thus, on the one hand, she repeatedly denied the danger. On the other, drew me a picture of spreading crime, extortion, assault, theft, usury, revenge followed by revenge. The secret red book that Manuela maintained, and that after her death had passed to Michele, was now controlled by Marcello, who was also taking away from his brother, out of distrust, the management of the legal and illegal trafficking, the political friendships. She said suddenly, Marcello has been bringing drugs to the neighborhood for several years, and I want to see where it's going to end up. A remark like that. She was very pale, fanning herself with the edge of her skirt. Of all her illusions, only the one to drugs struck me, particularly because of her tone of disgust and disapproval. Drugs for me at that time meant Maria Rosa's house, or on certain evenings, the apartment on Via Tasso. I had never used drugs, apart from smoking once or twice, out of curiosity. But I wasn't outraged if others did. In the circles I had frequented and did frequent, no one was outraged. So, to keep the conversation going, I stated an opinion, drawing on the days in Milan and on Maria Rosa, for whom taking drugs was one of many channels for individual well-being, a way of freeing oneself from taboos, a cultivated form of release. But Lila shook her head in opposition. What release, Lenu? The son of Signora Palmieri died 2 weeks ago. They found him in the gardens. And I perceived the irritation she felt at that word, release, at my way of saying it, assigning it a positive value. I stiffened. I ventured, he must have had some heart trouble. She answered, he had heroin trouble. And she quickly added, that's enough. I'm fed up. I don't want to spend Sunday talking about the revolting activities of the Saladas. Yet she had done so, and more than usual. A long moment slipped by. Out of restlessness, out of weariness, out of choice, I don't know. Lila had slightly widened the net of her conversation, and I realized that even if she hadn't said much, she had filled my head with new images. I had long known that Michele wanted her, in that abstractly obsessive way that was harmful to him. And it was clear that she had taken advantage of it by bringing him to his knees. But now she had evoked the shadow of her shadow, and with that expression had thrust before my eyes Alfonso. The Alfonso who posed as a reflection of her in a maternity dress in the store on Via dei Mille. And I had seen Michele, a dazzled Michele, lifting his dress, holding him tight. As for Marcello, in a flash, drugs stopped being what they had seemed to me, a liberating game for wealthy people, and moved into the sticky theater of the gardens beside the church. They had become a viper, a poison that spread through the blood of my brothers, of Reno, perhaps of Gennaro, and murdered, and brought money into the red book once kept by Manuela Solada, and now, having passed from Michele to Marcello, by my sister, in her house. I felt all the fascination of the way Leela governed the imagination of others, or set it free at will, with just a few words. That speaking, stopping, letting images and emotions go without adding anything else. I'm wrong, I said to myself in confusion, to write as I've done until now, recording everything I know. I should write the way she speaks, leave abysses, construct bridges and not finish them, force the reader to establish the flow. Marcello Solada, who takes off quickly with my sister Elisa, with Silvio, with Pepe, with Gianni, with Reno, with Gennaro, with Michele, enthralled by the shadow of the shadow of Leela, suggest that they all slip inside the veins of Signora Palmieri's son, a boy I don't even know and who now causes me pain, veins far away from those of the people Nino brings to Via Tasso, from Maria Rosa's, from those of a friend of hers, I now remembered, who was sick and had to detox. And my sister-in-law, too, wherever she is. I haven't heard from her for a long time. Some people are always saved, and some perish. I tried to expel images of voluptuous penetrations between men, of needles in veins, of desire and death. I tried to resume the conversation, but something wasn't right. I felt the heat of that late afternoon in my throat. I remember that my legs felt heavy and my neck was sweaty. I looked at the clock on the kitchen wall. It was just after 7:30. I discovered I no longer felt like talking about Nino, like asking Leela, sitting opposite me in a low yellowish light, what do you know about him that I don't know? She knew a lot. Too much. She could make me imagine whatever she wanted, and I would never be able to erase the images from my mind. They had slept together. They had studied together. She had helped him write his articles, as I had done with the essays. For a moment, jealousy and envy returned. They hurt me, and I repressed them. Or probably what actually repressed them was a kind of thunder under the building, under the stradone, as if one of the trucks that were constantly passing had swerved in our direction, was descending rapidly underground with the engine at top speed, and running into our foundations, crashing and shattering everything. 49. My breath was cut short, and for a fraction of a second, I couldn't understand what was happening. The coffee cup trembled on the saucer. The leg of the table bumped my knee. I jumped up and realized that Leela, too, was alarmed. She was trying to get up. The chair was tilting backward. She tried to grasp it, but slowly, bent over, one hand reaching in front of her, in my direction. The other extended toward the chair back, her eyes narrowing, the way they did when she concentrated before reacting. Meanwhile, thunder rumbled beneath the building. A stormy underground wind lifted waves of a secret sea against the floor. I looked at the ceiling. The light was swaying, along with the pink glass cover. "Earthquake!" I cried. The earth was moving, an invisible tempest exploding under my feet, shaking the room with the howl of a forest subdued by gusts of wind. The walls creaked, They appeared distended. They came unstuck and were pasted together again at the corners. A cloud of dust rained down from the ceiling, adding to the cloud that came out of the walls. I rushed toward the door, shouting again, "Earthquake!" But the movement was mere intention. I couldn't take a step. My feet were like lead. Everything was heavy. My head, my chest, above all, my stomach. And yet the ground on which I wanted to step was receding. For a fraction of a second, it was there, and then immediately it subsided. I remembered Leela. I sought her with my gaze. The chair had finally fallen over. The ceiling light was swaying. The furniture, especially an old sideboard with its knick-knacks, glasses, silverware, chinoiserie, vibrated along with the window panes, like weeds growing in the eaves, stirred by the breeze. Leela was standing in the middle of the room, leaning forward, head down, eyes narrowed, brow furrowed, her hands holding her stomach as if she were afraid that it would slip away from her and get lost in the cloud of plaster dust. The seconds slid by, but nothing appeared to want to return to order. I called to her. She didn't respond. She seemed solid, the only one of all the shapes impervious to jolts, tremors. She seemed to have erased every feeling. Her ears didn't hear. Her throat didn't inhale air. Her mouth was locked. Her eyelids canceled her gaze. She was a motionless organism, rigid, alive only in the hands that, fingers spread, gripped her stomach. "Leela," I called. I moved to grab her, drag her away. It was the most urgent thing to do. The lower part of me, the part I thought was exhausted, but instead, here it was reviving, suggested to me, "Maybe you should be like her. Stand still. Bend over to protect your infant. Don't run away. Think calmly." I struggled to make up my mind. To reach her was difficult, and yet it was just a step. Finally, I seized her by the arm. I shook her, and she opened her eyes, which seemed white. The noise was unbearable. The whole city was making noise. Vesuvius, the streets, the sea, the old houses of the Tribunali and the Quartieri, the new ones of Posillipo. She wriggled free. She cried, "Don't touch me." It was an angry shout, and shocked me even more than the long seconds of the earthquake. I realized that I was mistaken. Leela, always in control of everything, at that moment wasn't in control of anything. She was immobilized by horror, fearful that if I merely touched her, she would break. 50. I dragged her outside, tugging her violently, pushing, entreating. I was afraid the tremor that had paralyzed us would be followed immediately by another, more terrible, final, and that everything would collapse on top of us. I admonished her. I begged her. I reminded her that we had to rescue the creatures we carried in our wombs. So we flung ourselves into the wake of terrified cries, a growing clamor joined to frenzied movements. It seemed that the heart of the neighborhood, of the city, was about to burst. As soon as we reached the courtyard, Leela threw up. I fought the nausea that gripped my stomach. The earthquake. The earthquake of November 23, 1980, with its infinite destruction, entered into our bones. It expelled the habit of stability and solidity, the confidence that every second would be identical to the next, the familiarity of sounds and gestures, the certainty of recognizing them. A sort of suspicion of every form of reassurance took over, a tendency to believe in every prediction of bad luck, an obsessive attention to signs of the brittleness of the world, and it was hard to take control again. Minutes and minutes and minutes that wouldn't end. Outside was worse than inside. Everything was moving and shouting. We were assaulted by rumors that multiplied the terror. Red flashes could be seen in the direction of the railroad. Vesuvius had reawakened. The sea was beating against Mergellina, the city hall, Chiatamone. The cemetery of the Pianto had sunk, along with the dead. Poggio Reale had collapsed entirely. The prisoners were either under the ruins or had escaped, and now were murdering people just for the hell of it. The tunnel that led to the marina had collapsed, burying half the fleeing neighborhood. Fantasies fed on one another, and Leela, I saw, believed everything. She trembled as she clung to my arm. "The city is dangerous," she whispered. "We have to go. The houses are cracking. Everything is falling on us. The sewers are spurting into the air. Look how the rats are escaping." Since people were running to their cars and the streets were becoming congested, she began to pull me. She whispered, "They're all going to the countryside. It's safer there." She wanted to run to her car. She wanted to get to an open space where only the sky, which seemed weightless, could fall on our heads. I couldn't calm her. We reached the car, but Leela didn't have the keys. We had fled without taking anything. We had pulled the door shut behind us, and even if we had found the courage, we couldn't go back to the house. I seized one of the door handles with all my strength and pulled it, shook it, but Leela shrieked. She put her hands over her ears, as if my action produced intolerable sounds and vibrations. Looking around, I saw a big rock that had fallen out of a wall and used it to break a window. "I'll get it fixed later," I said. "Now let's stay here. It will pass." We settled ourselves in the car, but nothing passed. We felt a continuous trembling of the earth. Beyond the dusty windshield, we watched the people of the neighborhood who had gathered in small groups to talk. But when at last things seemed quiet, someone ran by shouting, which caused a general stampede, and people slammed into our car with heart-stopping violence. 51. I was afraid. Yes, I was terrified. But to my great amazement, I wasn't as frightened as Leela. In those seconds of the earthquake, she had suddenly stripped off the woman she had been until a moment before, the one who was able to precisely calibrate thoughts, words, gestures, tactics, strategies. As if in that situation, she considered her a useless suit of armor. Now she was someone else. She was the person I had glimpsed the time Melina walked along the Stradone eating soap, or the one of the night of New Year's Eve in 1958, when the fireworks war broke out between the Caracis and the Saladas, or the one who had sent for me in San Giovanni a Tiruccio, when she worked in Bruno Saccavo's factory and, thinking something was wrong with her heart, wanted to leave me Gennaro because she was sure she would die. But now, that other person seemed to have emerged directly from the churning guts of the earth. She bore almost no resemblance to the friend who, a few minutes before, I had envied for her ability to choose words deliberately. There was no resemblance even in the features, disfigured by anguish. I could never have undergone such an abrupt metamorphosis. My self-discipline was stable. The world existed around me in a natural way, even in the most terrible moments. I knew that Dede and Elsa were with their father in Florence, and Florence was an elsewhere out of danger, which in itself calmed me. I hoped that the worst had passed, that no house in the neighborhood had collapsed, that Nino, my mother, my father, Elisa, my brothers were surely, like us, frightened, but surely, like us, alive. She, on the other hand, no, she couldn't think in that way. She writhed, she trembled, she caressed her stomach. She no longer seemed to believe in solid connections. For her, Gennaro and Enzo had lost every connection with each other and with us. They were destroyed. She emitted a sort of death rattle, eyes wide. She clutched herself, held tight, and she repeated obsessively adjectives and nouns that were completely incongruous with the situation we were in. She uttered sentences without sense, and yet she uttered them with conviction, tugging on me. For a long time, it was useless for me to point out people we knew, to open the window, wave my arms, call out to anchor her to names, to voices that would have their own stories of that terrible experience, and so draw her into an orderly conversation. I pointed out Carmen, with her husband and children, and others, hurrying, on foot, toward the station. I pointed out Antonio with his wife and children. I was astonished at how handsome they all were, like characters in a film, as they calmly got into a green van, which then left. I pointed out to her the Karachi family and their relations, husbands, wives, fathers, mothers, people living together, lovers, that is to say, Stefano, Ada, Melina, Maria, Pinuccia, Rino, Alfonso, Marisa, and all their children, who appeared and disappeared in the throng, shouting continuously for fear of losing each other. I pointed out Marcello Salata's fancy car that was trying, with a roar, to get free of the jam of vehicles. He had my sister Elisa with her child next to him, and in the back seat, the pale shadows of my mother and father. I shouted names with the window open. I tried to involve Leela, too. But she wouldn't move. In fact, I realized that the people, especially those we knew well, frightened her even more, especially if they were agitated, if they were shouting, if they were running. She squeezed my hand hard and closed her eyes when, against all the rules, Marcello's car went up on the sidewalk, honking, and made its way amid the people who were standing there talking or were hauling things along. She exclaimed, "Oh, Madonna," an expression I had never heard her use. "What's wrong?" I asked. Gasping for breath, she cried out that the car's boundaries were dissolving. The boundaries of Marcello, too, at the wheel were dissolving. The thing and the person were gushing out of themselves, mixing liquid metal and flesh. She used that term, dissolving boundaries. It was on that occasion that she resorted to it for the first time. She struggled to elucidate the meaning. She wanted me to understand what the dissolution of boundaries meant and how much it frightened her. She was still holding my hand tight, breathing hard. She said that the outlines of things and people were delicate, that they broke like cotton thread. She whispered that for her, it had always been that way. An object lost its edges and poured into another, into a solution of heterogeneous materials, emerging and mixing. She exclaimed that she had always had to struggle to believe that life had firm boundaries, for she had known since she was a child that it was not like that. It was absolutely not like that. And so she couldn't trust in their resistance to being banged and bumped. Contrary to what she had been doing, she began to utter a profusion of overexcited sentences, sometimes kneading in the vocabulary of the dialect, sometimes drawing on the vast reading she had done as a girl. She muttered that she mustn't ever be distracted. If she became distracted, real things, which, with their violent, painful contortions, terrified her, would gain the upper hand over the unreal ones, which, with their physical and moral solidity, pacified her. She would be plunged into a sticky, jumbled reality, and would never again be able to give sensations clear outlines. A tactile emotion would melt into a visual one. A visual one would melt into an olfactory one. Ah, what is the real world, Lainu? Nothing, nothing, nothing about which one can say conclusively, it's like that. And so, if she didn't stay alert, if she didn't pay attention to the boundaries, the waters would break through. A flood would rise, carrying everything off in clots of menstrual blood, in cancerous polyps, in bits of yellowish fiber. 52. She spoke for a long time. It was the first and last time she tried to explain to me the feeling of the world she moved in. Up to now, she said, and here I summarize in my own words of the present. I thought it was a matter of bad moments that came and then passed, like a childhood illness. Do you remember New Year's Eve of 1958, when the Salatas shot at us? The shots were the least frightening part. First, even before they started shooting, I was afraid that the colors of the fireworks were sharp. The green and the purple, especially, were razor-like, that they could butcher us, that the trails of the rockets were scraping my brother Reno like files, like rasps, and broke his flesh, caused another disgusting brother to drip out of him, whom I had to put back inside right away, inside his usual form, or he would turn against me and hurt me. All my life, I've done nothing, Lainu, but hold back moments like those. Marcello scared me, and I protected myself with Stefano. Stefano scared me, and I protected myself with Michele. Michele scared me, and I protected myself with Nino. Nino scared me, and I protected myself with Enzo. But what does that mean? Protect. It's only a word. I could make you, now, a detailed list of all the coverings, large and small, that I constructed to keep myself hidden, and yet they were of no use to me. Do you remember how the night sky of Ischia horrified me? You all said how beautiful it is, but I couldn't. I smelled an odor of rotten eggs, eggs with a greenish-yellow yolk inside the white, and inside the shell, a hard-boiled egg cracked open. I had in my mouth poisoned egg stars. Their light had a white, gummy consistency. It stuck to your teeth, along with the gelatinous black of the sky. I crushed it with disgust. I tasted a crackling of grit. Am I clear? Am I making myself clear? And yet, on Ischia, I was happy, full of love. But it was no use. My head always finds a chink to peer through, beyond, above, beneath, on the side, where the fear is. In Bruno's factory, for example, the bones of the animals cracked in your fingers if you merely touched them, and a rancid marrow spilled out. I was so afraid that I thought I was sick. But was I sick? Did I really have a murmur in my heart? No. The only problem has always been the disquiet of my mind. I can't stop it. I always have to do, redo, cover, uncover, reinforce, and then suddenly undo, break. Take Alfonso. He's always made me nervous, ever since he was a boy. I felt that the cotton thread that held him together was about to break. And Michele? Michele thought he was who knows what. And yet all I had to do was find his boundary line and pull. Oh, 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 I broke it. I broke his cotton thread and tangled it with Alfonso's. Male material, inside male material. The fabric that I weave by day is unraveled by night. The head finds a way. But it's not much use. The terror remains. It's always in the crack between one normal thing and the other. It's there, waiting. I've always suspected it. And since yesterday evening, I've known for certain. Nothing lasts, Lenu. Even here in my belly, you think the creature will endure, but it won't. You remember when I married Stefano, and I wanted the neighborhood to start again from the beginning, to be only beautiful things? The ugliness of before was not supposed to be there anymore. How long did it last? Good feelings are fragile. With me, love doesn't last. Love for a man doesn't last, not even love for a child. It soon gets a hole in it. You look in the hole, and you see the nebula of good intentions mixed up with the nebula of bad. Donato makes me feel guilty. This thing here in my belly is a responsibility that cuts me, scratches me. Loving courses together with hating, and I can't manage to solidify myself around any goodwill. Maestra Oliviero was right. I'm bad. I don't even know how to keep friendship alive. You're kind, Lenu. You've always had a lot of patience. But tonight, I finally understood it. There is always a solvent that acts slowly, with a gentle heat, and undoes everything, even when there's no earthquake. So please, if I insult you, if I say ugly things to you, stop up your ears. I don't want to do it, and yet I do. Please, please, don't leave me, or I'll fall in. 53. Yes, I kept saying. All right. But now rest. I held her tight beside me, and finally she fell asleep. I stayed awake watching her, as she had once begged me to do. Every so often I felt new, small aftershocks. Someone in a car shouted with terror. Now the stradone was empty. The infant moved in my belly like rolling waters. I touched Lila's stomach. Hers was moving too. Everything was moving. The sea of fire under the crust of the earth, and the furnaces of the stars, and the planets, and the universes, and the light within the darkness, and the silence in the cold. But, even now, as I pondered the wave of Leela's distraught words, I felt that in me, fear could not put down roots. And even the lava, the fiery stream of melting matter that I imagined inside the earthly globe and the fear it provoked in me, settled in my mind in orderly sentences, in harmonious images, became a pavement of black stones like the streets of Naples, a pavement where I was always, and no matter what, the center. I gave myself weight, in other words. I knew how to do that, whatever happened. Everything that struck me, my studies, books, Franco, Pietro, the children, Nino, the earthquake, would pass. And I, whatever I among those I was accumulating, I would remain firm. I was the needle of the compass that stays fixed while the lead traces circles around it. Lila, on the other hand, it seemed clear to me now, and it made me proud. It calmed me, touched me, struggled to feel stable. She couldn't. She didn't believe it. However much she had always dominated all of us and had imposed and was still imposing a way of being, on pain of her resentment and her fury, she perceived herself as a liquid, and all her efforts were, in the end, directed only at containing herself. When, in spite of her defensive manipulation of persons and things, the liquid prevailed, Lila lost Lila. Chaos seemed the only truth, and she, so active, so courageous, erased herself, and, terrified, became nothing. 54. The neighborhood emptied. The stradone became quiet. The air turned cold. In the buildings, transformed into dark rocks, There was not a single lamp lighted, no colorful glow of a television. I too fell asleep. I awoke with a start. It was still dark. Leela had left the car. The window on her side was half open. I opened mine. I looked around. The stopped cars were all inhabited. People coughed, groaned in their sleep. I didn't see Leela. I grew concerned. I went toward the tunnel. I found her, not far from Carmen's gas pump. She was moving amid fragments of cornices and other debris. She looked up toward the windows of her house. Seeing me, she had an expression of embarrassment. "I wasn't well," she said. "I'm sorry. I filled your head with nonsense. Luckily, we were together." There was the hint of an uneasy smile on her face. She said one of the many almost incomprehensible phrases of that night. "Luckily is a breath of perfume that comes out when you press the pump," and she shivered. She still wasn't well. I persuaded her to return to the car. In a few minutes, she fell asleep again. As soon as it was day, I woke her. She was calm. She wanted to apologize. She said softly, making light of it, "You know I'm like that. Every so often there's something that grabs me here in my chest." I said, "It's nothing. There are periods of exhaustion. You're looking after too many things. And anyway, it's been terrible for everyone. It wouldn't end." She shook her head. "I know how I'm made." We organized ourselves. We found a way of returning to her house. We made a great number of phone calls, but either they didn't go through or the phone rang in vain. Leela's parents didn't answer. The relatives in Avellino who could have given us news of Enzo and Gennaro didn't answer. No one answered at Nino's number. His friends didn't answer. I talked to Pietro. He had just found out about the earthquake. I asked him to keep the girls for a few days, long enough to be sure the danger had passed. But as the hours slid by, the dimensions of the disaster grew. We hadn't been frightened for nothing. Leela murmured, as if to justify herself. "You see, the earth was about to split in two." We were dazed by emotions and by weariness, but still we walked through the neighborhood and through a sorrowing city, now silent, now streaked by the nagging sounds of sirens. We kept talking to alleviate anxiety. Where was Nino? Where was Enzo? Where was Gennaro? How was my mother? Where had Marcello Salata taken her? Where were Leela's parents? I realized that she needed to return to the moments of the earthquake, and not so much to recount again its traumatic effects, as to feel them as a new heart around which to restructure sensibility. I encouraged her every time, and it seemed to me that the more she regained control of herself, the more evident became the destruction and death of entire towns of the South. Soon, she began to speak of the terror without being ashamed, and I was reassured. But something indefinable nevertheless remained. Her more cautious steps, a hint of apprehension in her voice. The memory of the earthquake endured. Naples contained it. Only the heat was departing, like a foggy breath that rose from the body of the city and its slow, strident life. We reached the house of Nino and Eleonora. I knocked for a long time. I called. No answer. Leela stood 100 meters away, staring at me, her belly stretched, pointed, a sulky expression on her face. I talked to a man who came out of the entrance with 2 suitcases. He said that the whole building was deserted. I stayed another moment, unable to make up my mind to leave. I observed Leela's figure. I remembered what she had said and implied shortly before the earthquake. I had the impression that a legion of demons was pursuing her. She used Enzo. She used Pasquale. She used Antonio. She remodeled Alfonso. She subdued Michele Salata, leading him into a mad love for her, for him. And Michele was thrashing about to free himself. He fired Alfonso. He closed the shop in Piazza dei Martiri, but in vain. Lila humiliated him, continued to humiliate him, subjugating him. How much did she know now of the two brothers' business? She had set eyes on their affairs when she collected data for the computer. She even knew about the drug money. That's why Marcello hated her. That's why my sister Elisa hated her. Lila knew everything. She knew everything out of pure, simple fear of all that was living or dead. Who knows how many ugly facts she knew about Nino? She seemed to say to me from a distance, "Forget him. We both know that he's safely with his family and doesn't give a damn about you." 55. It turned out to be essentially true. Enzo and Gennaro returned to the neighborhood in the evening, worn out, overwhelmed, looking like survivors of an atrocious war, with a single preoccupation. How was Lila? Nino, on the other hand, reappeared many days later, as if he'd come back from a vacation. "I couldn't understand anything," he said. "I took my children and fled." His children. What a responsible father. And the one I carried in my belly? He said in his confident voice that he had taken refuge with the children, Eleonora, his in-laws, in a family villa in Minturno. I sulked. I kept him away for days. I didn't want to see him. I was worried about my parents. I heard from Marcello himself, who had returned alone to the neighborhood, that he had brought them to a safe place, with Elisa and Silvio, to a property he had in Gaeta. Another savior of his family. Meanwhile, I returned to Via Tasso alone. It was very cold now. The apartment was freezing. I checked the walls one by one. There didn't seem to be any cracks. But at night, I was afraid to fall asleep. I feared that the earthquake would return, and I was glad that Pietro and Doriana had agreed to keep the children for a while. Then Christmas came. I couldn't help it. I made peace with Nino. I went to Florence to get Dede and Elsa. Life began again, but like a convalescence whose end I couldn't see. Now, every time I saw Lila, I felt on her part a mood of uncertainty, especially when she took an aggressive tone. She looked at me as if to say, "You know what is behind my every word." But did I really know? I crossed barricaded streets and passed by countless uninhabitable buildings shored up by strong wooden beams. I often ended up in the havoc caused by the basest complicit inefficiency. And I thought of Lila, of how she immediately returned to work, to manipulate, motivate, deride, attack. I thought of the terror that in a few seconds had annihilated her. I saw the trace of that terror in her now habitual gesture of holding her hands around her stomach with the fingers spread. And I wondered apprehensively, who is she now? What can she become? How can she react? I said to her once, to underline that a bad moment had passed, "The world has returned to its place." She replied teasingly, "What place?" 56. In the last month of pregnancy, everything became a struggle. Nino was hardly ever around. He had to work, and that exasperated me. When he did appear, he was rude. I thought, "I'm ugly. He doesn't want me anymore." And it was true. By now, I couldn't look at myself in the mirror without disgust. I had puffy cheeks and an enormous nose. My bosom and stomach seemed to have consumed the rest of my body. I saw myself without a neck, with short legs and fat ankles. I had become like my mother, but not the one of now, who was a thin, frightened old woman. Rather, I resembled the venomous figure I had always feared, who now existed only in my memory. That persecuting mother was unleashed. She began to act through me, venting because of the difficulties, the anxieties, the pain the dying mother was causing me with her frailties, the gaze of a person who is about to drown. I became intractable. Every complication seemed like a plot. I often started shouting. I had the impression, in my moments of greatest unhappiness, that the chaos of Naples had settled even in my body, that I was losing the capacity to be nice, to be likable. Pietro called to talk to the children, and I was brusque. The publisher called me, or some daily paper, and I protested. I said, "I'm in my 9th month. I'm stressed. Leave me alone." With my daughters, too, I got worse. Not so much with Dede, since she resembled her father, and I was by now accustomed to her mixture of intelligence, affection, and harassing logic. It was Elsa who began to upset me. The meek little girl was becoming a being with blurry features, whose teacher did nothing but complain about her, calling her sly and violent, while I myself, in the house or on the street, constantly scolded her for picking fights, taking others' things and breaking them when she had to give them back. "A fine trio of women we are," I said to myself. "It's obvious that Nino is avoiding us, that he prefers Eleonora, Albertina, and Lydia." When I couldn't sleep at night because of the creature stirring in my womb as if it were made of mobile air bubbles, I hoped against every prediction that the new baby would be a male, that he would resemble Nino, that he would please him, and that Nino would love him more than his other children. But although I forced myself to return to the image I preferred of myself, I had always wanted to be an even-tempered person who wisely curbed petty or even violent feelings. In those final days, I was unable to find an equilibrium. I blamed the earthquake, which, at the time, didn't seem to have disturbed me a great deal, but perhaps remained deep inside, right in my belly. If I drove through the tunnel of Capodimonte, I was gripped by panic. I was afraid that a new shock would make it collapse. If I took the Corso Malta viaduct, which vibrated anyway, I accelerated to escape the shock that might shatter it at any moment. In that phase, I even stopped battling the ants, which often and willingly appeared in the bathroom. I preferred to let them live, and every so often observe them. Alfonso claimed that they could anticipate disaster. But it wasn't only the aftermath of the earthquake that upset me. Leela's fantastical hints also entered into it. I now looked on the streets for syringes, like the ones I had absent-mindedly noticed in the days of Milan. And if I saw some in the gardens in the neighborhood, a querulous mist rose around me. I wanted to go and confront Marcello and my brothers, even if it wasn't clear to me what arguments I would use. Thus, I ended up doing and saying hateful things. To my mother, who harassed me, asking if I had talked to Leela about Pepe and Gianni, I responded rudely one day. "Ma, Lena can't take them. She already has a brother who's a drug addict, and she's afraid for Gennaro. You can't all burden her with the problems you can't fix." She looked at me in horror. She had never alluded to drugs. I had said a word that shouldn't be said. But if in earlier times she would have started shouting in defense of my brothers and against my lack of sensitivity, now, she shut herself in a dark corner of the kitchen and didn't breathe a word, so that I had to say, repentant, "Don't worry. Come on. We'll find a solution." What solution? I made things even more complicated. I tracked down Pepe in the gardens, who knows where Johnny was, and made an angry speech about how terrible it was to earn money from the vices of others. I said, "Go find any job, but not this. You'll ruin yourself and make our mother die of worry." The whole time he was cleaning the nails of his right hand with the nail of his left thumb, and he listened to me uneasily, eyes lowered. He was 3 years younger than me, and felt like the little brother in front of the big sister, who was an important person. But that didn't keep him from saying to me, at the end, with a sneer, "Without my money, Mama would already be dead." He went away with a faint wave of farewell. That answer got me even more upset. I let a day or two go by and went to see Elisa, hoping to find Marcello, too. It was very cold. The streets of the new neighborhood were as damaged and dirty as those of the old. Marcello wasn't there. The house was untidy, and I found my sister's slovenliness annoying. She hadn't washed or dressed. All she did was take care of her son. I almost scolded her. "Tell your husband," and I stressed that word, husband, even though they weren't married, "that he's ruining our brothers. If he has to sell drugs, let him do it himself." I expressed myself like that, in Italian, and she turned pale. She said, "Lenu, leave my house immediately. Who do you think you're talking to? All those fancy people you know? Get out. You're presumptuous. You always were." As soon as I tried to reply, she shouted, "Don't ever come here again acting like the professor about my Marcello. He's a good person. We owe everything to him. If I want to, I can buy you, that whore Lena, and all the shits you admire so much." 57. I got more and more involved in the neighborhood that, because of Leela, I had glimpsed, and realized only later that I was getting mixed up in activities that were difficult to sort out, and was violating, among other things, a rule I had made when I returned to Naples, not to be sucked back into the place where I was born. One afternoon, when I had left the children with Mirella, I went to see my mother, and then, I don't know whether to soothe my agitation or to give vent to it, I went to Leela's office. Ada opened the door, cheerfully. Leela was closed in her room and arguing with a client. Enzo had gone with Reno to visit some business or other, and she felt it her duty to keep me company. She entertained me with talk about her daughter Maria, on how big she was, how good she was in school. But then the telephone rang. She hurried to answer, calling to Alfonso, "Linutra's here, come." With a certain embarrassment, my former schoolmate, more feminine than ever in his ways, in his hair, in the colors of his clothes, led me into a small, bare space. There, to my surprise, I found Michele Salata. I hadn't seen him for a long time, and an unease took possession of all three of us. Michele seemed very changed. He had gone gray, and his face was lined, although his body was still young and athletic. But the oddest thing was that he appeared to be embarrassed by my presence and behaved in a completely uncharacteristic way. First of all, he stood up when I entered. Then he was polite, but said very little. His usual teasing patter had disappeared. He kept looking at Alfonso, as if he were seeking help, then immediately looked away, as if merely looking at him could be compromising. And Alfonso was just as uncomfortable. He kept smoothing his long hair. He smacked his lips in search of something to say, and the conversation soon languished. The moments seemed fragile to me. I became nervous, but I didn't know why. Maybe it annoyed me that they were hiding from me, no less, as if I couldn't understand. From me, who had frequented and did frequent circles more progressive than that little neighborhood room, who had written a book praised even abroad on how brittle sexual identities were. On the tip of my tongue was the wish to exclaim, "If I've understood correctly, you are lovers." I didn't do it, only out of fear of having mistaken Leela's hints. But certainly I couldn't bear the silence, and I talked a lot, pushing the conversation in that direction. I said to Michele, "Giliola told me you're separated."
"Yes."
"I'm also separated."
"I know, and I also know who you're with."
"You never liked Nino."
"No, but people have to do what they feel like, otherwise they get sick."
"Are you still in Posillipo?" Alfonso interrupted enthusiastically.
"Yes, and the view is fabulous."
Michele looked at him with irritation. He said, "I'm happy there." I answered, "People are never happy alone."
"Better alone than in bad company," he answered.
Alfonso must have perceived that I was looking for a chance to say something unpleasant to Michele, and he tried to focus my attention on himself. He exclaimed, "And I'm about to separate from Marisa," and he related in great detail certain quarrels with his wife on money matters. He never mentioned love, sex, or even her infidelities. Instead, he continued to insist on the money. He spoke obscurely of Stefano and alluded only to the fact that Marisa had pushed out Ada. Women take men away from other women without any scruples, in fact, with great satisfaction. His wife, in his words, seemed no more than an acquaintance whose doings could be talked about with irony. "Think what a waltz," he said, laughing. "Ada took Stefano from Leela, and now Marisa is taking him away from her." I sat listening and slowly rediscovered, but as if I were dragging it up from a deep well, the old solidarity of the time when we sat at the same desk. Yet only then did I understand that even if I had never been aware that he was different, I was fond of him precisely because he wasn't like the other boys. Precisely because of that peculiar alienation from the male behaviors of the neighborhood. And now, as he spoke, I discovered that that bond endured. Michele, on the other hand, annoyed me more than ever. He muttered some vulgarities about Marisa. He was impatient with Alfonso's conversation. At a certain point, he interrupted in the middle of a sentence almost angrily, "Will you let me have a word with Linucha?" and asked about my mother. He knew she was ill. Alfonso became suddenly silent, blushing. I started talking about my mother, purposely emphasizing how worried she was about my brothers. I said, "She's not happy that Pepe and Gianni work for your brother."
"What's the problem with Marcello?"
"I don't know. You tell me. I heard that you don't get along anymore." He looked at me almost in embarrassment.
"You heard wrong. And anyway, if your mother doesn't like Marcello's money, she can send them to work under someone else."
I was on the point of reproaching him for that "under." My brother's under Marcello. Under him. Under someone else. My brothers, whom I hadn't helped with school, and now, because of me, they were under. Under? No human being should be under, much less under the Solatas. I felt even more dissatisfied and had a desire to quarrel. But Leela came out. "Ah, what a crowd," she said, and turned to Michele. "You need to talk to me?"
"Yes."
"Will it take long?"
"Yes."
"Then first I'll talk to Linucha." He nodded timidly. I got up and, looking at Michele, but touching Alfonso on the arm as if to push him toward Michele, said, "One of these nights you two must invite me to Posillipo. I'm always alone."
I can do the cooking.
Michele opened his mouth, but no sound came out. Alfonso